Many consider that conflict a massacre and have called for the soldiers to be stripped of their medals of honor. Hegseth dismissed the idea as political correctness run amok and released a video defending the soldiers and their medals. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it was a painful message for tribes throughout the country.
Under my direction, we're making it clear without hesitation that the soldiers who fought in the Battle of Wounded Knee in 1890 will keep their medals.
Although bipartisan efforts in Congress to rescind those medals go back decades, only a president has the legal authority beyond the Pentagon itself to undo that distinction.
This decision is now final, and their place in our nation's history is no longer up for debate. We salute their memory, we honor their service, and we will never forget what they did.
In what would be the final chapter of the Army's century-long Indian Wars campaign, as many as 300 Lakotas were killed at Wounded Knee in South Dakota, while at least 25 U.S. soldiers died. A rifle shot rang out when troops tried disarming a surrendering encampment on December 29, 1890. In that confusion, the mass slaughter of mostly unarmed men, women, and children ensued. Army General Nelson Appleton Miles penned in private, quote, "I have never heard of a more brutal, cold-blooded massacre than that at Wounded Knee." To this day, there is still no official death count. Hegseth's comments came a few weeks after President Trump signed an executive order rebranding his agency as the Department of War.
This is something we thought long and hard about. We've been talking about it for months, Pete and I, and I think it's a much more appropriate name, especially in light of where the world is right now.
From the Russian invasion of Ukraine to the Israeli-Hamas conflict in Gaza, the same dynamics of Wounded Knee, of civilians being killed by conquering military forces, continue to play out all around the world.
And that's National Native News for today. So glad to have you with us for the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 11th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Josh Salem, and Brian Bayhuth. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The U.S. National Security Strategy Paper puts Europe on edge. Europe's planned big loan to Ukraine is floundering, and fallout over the U.S. boat attacks intensifies. First, the U.S. National Security Strategy Paper puts Europe on edge. The Trump administration has issued a national security strategy document that fundamentally transforms U.S. relations with Europe. Traditional closeness is out. open hostility to liberal governments and alignment with far-right parties are in. Europe, says the document, is facing the, quote, stark prospect of civilizational erasure because of immigration and climate change policies. The document pledges that the U.S. will support like-minded patriotic parties across the continent to prevent a future in which, quote, certain NATO members will become majority non-European. Without naming them directly, the document says the U.S. should be cultivating resistance across Europe by supporting political parties that fight against migration and promote nationalism. That describes several right-wing populist parties like Reform UK in Britain and the Alternative for Germany, known as AFD. We want Europe to remain European, says the document, to regain its civilizational self-confidence and to abandon its failed focus on regulatory sophistication. Another U.S. official went farther. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Christopher Landau, said the, quote, unelected, undemocratic, and unrepresentative European Union was undermining U.S. security. And Tuesday, Trump amplified his criticisms, saying Europe is weak and decaying, and claiming it was destroying itself through immigration. European reaction has been swift and angry. The President of the European Council of National Leaders, Antonio Costa, said, quote, what we cannot accept is the threat to interfere in European politics. Allies do not threaten to interfere in the domestic political choices of their allies. The U.S. cannot replace Europe in what its vision is of free expression. Europe must be sovereign, unquote. Nikolai von Andarza, the head of European research at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, said the U.S. strategy, quote, really represents a fundamental shift in transatlantic relations. It means open U.S. backing for regime change in Europe. Minna Alander of the Center for European Policy Analysis said the U.S. document was, quote, actually useful. It codifies in policy, in black and white, what has been evident all year long. Trump and his people are openly hostile to Europe. The incendiary language in the National Security Strategy paper isn't entirely new. Recall how Trump, at the United Nations in September, characterized Europe's push for regulating greenhouse gases, talking of it as being civilizational decline. The strategy paper also echoes Vice President Vance's speech in Munich in February, when he took European leaders to task for suppressing the far right. The rift with Europe is fodder for Moscow, whose widening sabotage campaign in Europe would now seem to have the U.S. on its side. Europe's planned big loan to Ukraine is floundering. For many months, the European Union had been seeking a way to release frozen Russian assets held mainly in Belgium as a major loan to Ukraine for post-war rebuilding. The original amount under consideration was around $240 billion. Now it seems the Europeans are going along with Trump, lowering the amount of the loan to $186 billion and even to $105 billion. The difference gives Trump incentives to offer Russia to promote investments, which would personally benefit Trump's billionaire cronies. Though Belgium's concern about the legality of the loan and Hungary's opposition to it also complicate the loan idea. But mostly, the declining figure reflects the EU's weak position in the peace negotiations that the Witkoff-Kushner team are leading. As one writer puts it, quote, in short, European officials may end up offering Ukraine a financial band-aid when they had hoped for a financial bazooka. It is a make-or-break moment for Europe and for Europe's importance on the global stage. So said Daniel Hegedus, a regional director for the German Marshall Fund, an important think tank. The European Union will meet December 18 to make a final decision on the loan. Ukraine is faring better with military aid from Europe. Norway, Germany, and Poland have pledged $500 million in additional military aid as part of a NATO initiative, minus the United States. Fallout over the U.S. boat attacks intensifies. The patently illegal U.S. attacks on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific have created a firestorm in Congress, with a number of Republicans joining Democrats in questioning, if not denouncing, the attacks. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's apparent order during the first such attack on September 2nd to kill everyone on board has led to demands for oral and video tapes of that order. Hegseth now claims he wasn't around for the order to kill two boat people who survived the initial attack. and that the order came amidst the fog of war. Well, there was no war and no fog, Mr. Hegseth. Trump at first said he saw no problem in releasing the tapes, then did his usual backtracking and said it was up to Hegseth to make that decision, and Hegseth isn't offering. The admiral who carried out Hegseth's order testified in closed session, after which Democratic Representative Jim Himes said the unretouched video of the September 2nd attack was, quote, one of the most troubling scenes he had seen in public service. The administration continues to insist Hegseth acted within his legal authority, defined by Trump as meaning defense of Americans from drug trafficking. So far, there have been 21 U.S. strikes that have killed 83 people. It is now firmly established that Admiral Alvin Halsey, the head of U.S. Southern Command who quit 2 years ahead of his planned departure, disagreed with the boat attacks and fumed regularly with Hegseth. The admiral is supposed to give public testimony soon. In other news, Trump is exasperated with Zelensky and his peace plan is sinking. The Witkoff-Kushner mission to Moscow has failed to convince Vladimir Putin that a ceasefire is better than more fighting. Putin firmly rejected the plan that Witkoff had concocted with Putin's advisor, Yuri Ushakov. Territory seems to be the crucial issue for Putin, as it always has been. It's either all of the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine or no deal, he said last week. Trump now says the talks with Russia are, quote, a mess, but that's not enough to put the U.S. on Ukraine's side. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, with strong backing from the EU, has made clear that he cannot accept a plan that concedes Ukrainian territory to Russia. Trump insists Zelensky hasn't read the plan and, quote, has to start accepting things, since Russia, quote, has the upper hand. The other day, Trump went on one of his rants saying, quote, they, meaning the Ukrainians, are using war not to hold an election. I would think the Ukrainian people should have that choice. And maybe Zelensky would win, I don't know who would win, but they haven't had an election in a long time. You know, they talk about a democracy, but it gets to a point where it's not a democracy anymore, unquote. Zelensky rejected that argument, that he's clinging to power and avoiding an election, saying Trump was being, quote, completely unreasonable. This is a question for the people of Ukraine, not the people of other states, Zelensky said. I'll be honest, I'm ready for elections. He said he would ask Ukraine's legislature to change martial law to allow for elections. Expect a lot more pressure from Trump on Ukraine in the days ahead. And don't be surprised if he decides to walk away from Ukraine altogether. Next, that $20 billion bailout of Argentina has been pared back. A planned $20 billion bailout to Argentina from J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup has been shelved as bankers pivot instead to a $5 billion short-term loan package to be used by Argentina to pay off its debt. The Trump administration had been seeking to bolster Argentine President Javier Milei's right-wing party when they announced a financial package that included a $20 billion currency swap with the U.S. Treasury Department and plans for a separate $20 billion bank-led debt facility. The Treasury Department is still providing funds to Argentina, but is withholding information on how the money is being spent. All Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent will say is that, quote, the Argentine economic bridge has now turned a profit for the American people. An Indian conglomerate will stop buying Russian oil, but India-Russia relations remain close. India's largest purchaser of Russian oil, Reliance Industries, announced that it would stop doing so December 1 in an apparent concession to Trump, who had tacked on a 25% tariff to the existing 25% tariff on imports from India to show his displeasure with those oil purchases. Trump has made ending India's oil dealings with Russia a condition for a U.S.-India trade deal. Nevertheless, India-Russia relations remain close. Vladimir Putin arrived December 4 for a 2-day visit to India, the first since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and was given a lavish reception by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Modi said, quote, India-Russia friendship is a time-tested one that has greatly benefited our people. Ahead of the trip, officials worked to finalize a deal for India to pay about $2 billion to lease a nuclear-powered submarine from Russia. Russia-India trade has been climbing over the last 3 years, now approaching about $150 billion a year. China's trade surplus sets another record. Last year, China's international trade set a record with a surplus of exports over imports valued at $1 trillion. This year is even better. The surplus was $1 trillion in the first 11 months. The political significance of this development is noteworthy. First, the surplus shows that the high U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods have not slowed China's export steamroller. Second, the surplus indicates ongoing problems for China in relations with its European and other markets, where cheaper Chinese goods are overwhelming locally produced goods and making it difficult for many manufacturing plants to stay competitive. China's economic planners will again face accusations that their country is exporting overcapacity. And third, the export boom reflects a weak Chinese currency, the renminbi, raising the question whether the RMB is undervalued. A stronger RMB, some Chinese economists argue, would make imports cheaper and strengthen consumer demand, which has been a major domestic problem for China's leaders. Next, China-U.S. research collaboration has fallen sharply. An Australian think tank that tracks global research collaboration reports that U.S.-China research collaboration has fallen back to 2005 levels, a decline that began with the infamous China Initiative in the U.S. Justice Department to investigate ethnic Chinese researchers in the U.S. Only a quarter of the collaborations are with U.S. researchers now. Chinese are increasingly working with researchers in Pakistan, Belarus, and Saudi Arabia. The Australian report says, quote, "The retreat comes at a time when China now generates almost 40% of global research output and dominates most critical technologies. Past collaborations between the world's two largest economies have produced advances ranging from genomics and earthquake monitoring to energy efficiency and agricultural productivity." Those days are now nearly gone. News from Israel and Gaza: Netanyahu on trial and Hamas on disarming. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been on trial for corruption since 2020 on charges that basically involve favors for business people in exchange for gifts. The war with Hamas had given him a reprieve of sorts, but now he's back in the trenches. Mimicking Trump, he has denied all charges and pressed Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, for a pardon. As the New York Times reports, quote, "Mr. Netanyahu's petition to Herzog admitted nothing and expressed no contrition. In a one-page letter that he himself signed, he did not use the word pardon, instead stiffly requesting an end of the trial. It came a little more than 2 weeks after President Trump sent a letter to Mr. Herzog urging him to pardon Mr. Netanyahu. It's a witch hunt," said Trump. Like Trump, Netanyahu has assailed judges and denied all accountability. He has also made the pardon the top public issue, displacing his responsibility for Israel's lack of preparedness when Hamas struck and his attempts at changes in the judicial system. Netanyahu's political opponents say they would favor a pardon if Netanyahu would finally retire from politics. Fat chance. In Gaza, a senior member of Hamas's leadership says the group is ready to discuss, quote, "freezing or storing its weapons. We are open to have a comprehensive approach in order to avoid further escalations or in order to avoid any further clashes or explosions," said the spokesman. The prime minister of Qatar, meanwhile, denies that his country has funded Hamas. Qatar, he said, quote, "financially supported the people of Gaza, not Hamas." But he also said Qatar, quote, "would not finance the reconstruction of what others have destroyed in Gaza." And once again, Prime Minister Netanyahu has rejected calls for Palestinian statehood, saying during a visit by Germany's chancellor, quote, "the purpose of a Palestinian state is to destroy the Jewish state." And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. At this morning's meeting of Portland City Council's Climate Resilience and Land Use Committee, councilors heard updates on some of the latest redevelopment plans across the city, both public and private projects. Here's an excerpt.
Good morning, Chair Novick, councilors. Patricia Diefendorfer for the record, Chief Planner, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I'm here with colleagues from Parks, PBOT, and Prosper. We are here today to provide updates on a number of large-scale development projects that are in various stages of planning and development, both within the central city and elsewhere in the city. I'd like to invite other presenters to briefly introduce themselves before we begin.
Lauren McGuire, Portland Parks and Recreation, Asset and Development Division Manager.
Art Pierce, Deputy Director of Planning, Projects, and Programs at the Portland Bureau of Transportation.
Good morning, councilors. I'm Lisa Abwaff, Director of Development and Investment with Prosper Portland.
We appreciate this opportunity to provide updates on the concurrent efforts by many bureaus of the city to advance these projects, many of which are public-private partnerships with multiple partners, as you will see in the, later in the presentation. Each of these are catalytic projects on their own, and together they will transform the city, bringing needed housing, creating destinations that attract visitors, revitalizing the city's economy, and leveraging private development. Many of these projects also implement strategies of the housing production strategy. Just wanted to kind of mention that, or actions. For example, housing production strategy C1 is to implement and support catalytic projects, of which many of these are the catalytic projects that are mentioned in the housing production strategy. All right, so the next project is the Lower Albina Rose Quarter project. And once again, you can see some renderings, like a bird's eye view of the community investment plan that I'll tell you more about, and some renderings of the project. So for this, Albina Vision Trust's community investment plan is at the heart of the vision for the Lower Albina and Rose Quarter areas. AVT formed as a nonprofit in 2017. In 2018, they were awarded a metro planning grant for $385,000, and the city added an additional $75,000 via Prosper to support the community engagement process necessary to create a catalytic plan for the Albina area. AVT did so, and they conducted a robust community engagement process, leading with the Black community and with the city in partnership. From this engagement, the trust established a 50-year vision plan. There are a lot of elements to this plan. It represents 94 acres in Lower Albina. It has three main components, focusing on land use, wealth creation, and governance, and it would include future uses such as housing, commercial, cultural, and educational open space uses. The property included is currently privately owned, with the exception of the Blanchard site, for which AVT has an offer for purchase. That's the development of the PPS profit site would be a residential community with as many as 1,200 units. And along with the renovation investments at the Moda Center and Veterans Memorial Coliseum, and future activation around the venues, it will support a growing residential community and a vibrant entertainment district in the area. The city has been supporting this work in a number of ways, including a city technical advisory committee that has been assisting AVT with the implementation, specifically around preparing to develop an application, a master plan, a central city master plan application for the 10-acre profit site. The city's been providing data and mapping resources, responding to city policy and zoning questions, organizing opportunities for Bureau and staff leadership to meet with AVT to offer guidance on the plan. And BPS and Prosper have been participating in a monthly Metro City meeting with AVT to discuss a grant. So the city and AVT have been working together on a district plan for the area, with funding from an $800,000 federal Reconnecting Communities grant. That Reconnecting Albina district planning process, as it's called, AVT is part of the project team supporting community engagement on that project. Goal of that project is to create a land use, urban design, and street network framework plans for the area that will facilitate the future implementation of the community investment plan, the long-term vision represented by that plan. This foundational work may also lead to a next phase, which is there may be some Central City 2035 plan or code changes that will be needed to help realize that vision and to integrate a planned highway cover in the Rose Quarter area. into the area. So along with AVT, of course, other key partners, as you can see on the slide, include the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Historic Albina Advisory Board, and the Trailblazers. The concurrent projects that are happening in that area involve the construction of significant new infrastructure and public amenities, which my colleagues can talk about further.
The AVT priorities that were heard through their community engagement process included building a community where Black Portlanders felt at home, building wealth among broad demographics, creating hubs that form a critical mass of uses like educational, health, and food to serve the community, building a plan around Broadway for a lively Main Street, and then access to nature, the river, and recreational open spaces. The Albina Vision Investment Plan is similar to what BPS would consider a framework or a concept plan, as Patricia said. The organizing concepts are a close-knit neighborhood, activity hubs, food, education, arts, and wellness, building types determined by the Black contracting community, a continuum of open spaces, and the opportunity to strengthen the urban fabric around North Broadway. Also housing, of course, central to the wealth building component. PPNR is very supportive of the AVT plan and sees many beneficial aspects of the vision, particularly the creation of a new waterfront facing open space. It's described as a riverfront park with an arts hub. We have a couple items to work through with AVT currently. The access to the park is a little bit challenging because it's a riverfront park and you have to cross over Union Pacific Railroad. And we also have some safety concerns for people if they have access to the river at that point. The topography is a little bit steep and we want to make sure it's activated with lots of housing. We also, of course, have the challenge of future park funding for SDCs at the moment. We're also interested in partnership as the arts and culture facilities develop because it is envisioned just west of the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, particularly as it relates to and collaborating with other and existing parts arts institutions like the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center that Parks is working in partnership with them on. And it also serves as the North and Northeast Black community adjacent to Dawson Square Park on the interstate.
Great. Infrastructure sets the tone for a neighborhood, and Albina Vision envisions a neighborhood in which communities and family can come together and live comfortably and thrive. The street network, the public realm network, is not yet the backdrop for that vision. And so PBOT has been working together with other bureaus and ODOT to try to reimagine the infrastructure framework for this area. And so the largest move among that is partnering with the I-5 Rose Quarter project, in which there's both improvements to the main line of the freeway as well as surface improvements that include capping the freeway, including and creating local street connections and the framework for buildable space in that area. To complement that, PBOT has been leading an effort to create a new Main Street in Broadway and Widler that could become the armature of a new community, as well as working on developing the street grid that might be the sort of more finer grain local street connections, that such as what would anchor those 1,000 plus residents in the Blanchard Site redevelopment area. Each of those together have sort of their own journey. The main ones that we've been spending a lot of energy on right now is trying to support ODOT on their process. Actually, I have staff right now at the Oregon Transportation Commission as they're having a hearing about how to proceed with the Rose Quarter project. I'm sure you have read with a loss of federal funds and a challenging at the statewide level, bringing together that scale of infrastructure is just all the more challenging right now. Also for us, PBOT had received a $38 million grant to do the design and construction of Broadway and Widler. At that point, that all but $5 million has been rescinded, so we have some funds to be able to proceed with the design, but we don't currently have the funding to do the capital construction. So we look forward to continuing to work with the partners and figure out how we can bring these elements together to create the backdrop for this future community. So.
Okay. And as Lauren mentioned, the concepts of community building and wealth building were really important components of the community vision for Lower Albina. I do want to note we prepared this slide before 1803 had also announced their acquisition of the silo. So I would lift them up as an important partner for us to add to that key partners list, and really excited to kind of see their vision for what can happen both at the waterfront and at the silo site. Again, kind of the vision is expected to occur via what is called hubs that center around things like education, entrepreneurship, health, food, and the arts. We also know that housing is another important wealth building component of the community vision for Lower Albina. And I want to also lift up the Portland Housing Bureau's work. I hope some of the District 2 counselors had an opportunity to visit Albina 1 at its recent opening. PHB actually made a contribution of just over $14 million in metro housing bonds to that project. So there was an important contribution by the city. And it was a partnership between AVT and Edlin & Co. The project actually opened earlier this year. It offers 94 units of family housing, and it also has programming by POIC that connects residents to important employment training and career placement services. And then last but not least, also wanted to lift up that we do in fact own a lot of property down in Lower Albina, particularly around the Moda Center and the Veterans Memorial Coliseum. As Patricia mentioned, there are pretty significant improvements occurring to VMC, and we are in active conversations with the new owners about the Trailblazers transition and kind of the future of that venue as well. If we go to the next slide in terms of timeline, again, I think the things we wanted to highlight here of just immediate and near-term activities for your awareness, I think as Art mentioned, I think he called it infrastructure sets the setting, the stage for future development. I think a lot of the city's efforts and big lifts right now are certainly around the infrastructure and then largely taking on a supporting role for both AVT and 1803 funds activities down in Lower Albina as they move to acquire property or do some pre-development work, including a central city master plan on that site.
That was an excerpt of this morning's Climate Resilience and Land Use Committee meeting at Portland City Council. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration.